woke up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the news, so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
Again, anything you read these days is confusing, to say the least. That's why it's nice to be somewhat protected in your, in my opinion, in your portfolio, because you never know where this one's going to go. It's two big pieces of news this morning. The British and the U.S. appear to have a trade deal. A deal. A comprehensive agreement with the United Kingdom is going to last for years to come. According to CNBC. By the way, we have Professor Liu.
Good morning.
How are you, buddy?
Just good.
Give me a second here, and just as a... The news that's always kind of bizarre in this current world, I won't say out of this current Washington. Now, according to CNBC, Britain, which runs a trade deficit with the U.S., was spared the higher reciprocal tariffs when Trump announced the Liberation Day duties, though it was still hit with the baseline 10% levy. Now, if you go from there over to the U.S. trade deficit by country with the World Population Review, I've got United Kingdom, which would be Britain, right, with a 10% trade surplus. We import $62 billion and we export $72 billion. So, in any case, it's not very much one way or the other. Why is this such a big deal, or is it just these people just can't keep their mouth shut? And in the midst of all this, the president called Jerry Powell a fool for not lowering interest rate yesterday. Do you think that's productive?
I don't know. I don't know anymore.
I don't either. I just throw my hands up.
I think one of the guys I read regularly on the web noted that the danger of having somebody, and he generally supports Trump's initiatives, but he said the danger of having somebody like Donald Trump in there with the behavior that he engages in is that he kind of lowers the expectations and emphasizes us to bad conduct because it's going on continuously. And he said that in 2016. He said, I can't say I'm in favor of this guy being president because his conduct is going to, if he keeps it up, his conduct is going to lower the standards we expect of our elected officials.
What about our kids?
And so, that would be a side effect, obviously. And so, I think that's happened. I mean, people don't react, or at least we're not reacting the way we used to the kind of outrageous things that he says. Is it helpful? But you know. On the other hand, he occasionally gets what he wants. So I don't know whether it's helpful. He's one of the interesting things that's come out, of course, and I think I said this about halfway through his first administration, his superpower is causing people to reveal themselves, one of the superpowers, and causing the true whatever to emerge. And you know, maybe that's part of the, you know, part of the strategy with the name calling. On the other hand, and I tend to believe this is true, and I think you do too, I think he just blurts out whatever's in his head, and you know, is it helpful? I have absolutely no idea. Maybe Powell will react to it. In trying to prepare for the show today, I actually looked at Powell's remarks about you know, interest rates, and he reminded me, Tom, of Bud Grant.
Yeah.
When people would ask Bud Grant, what do you think is going to happen this week with the, you know, with the Vikings? And Bud would say, well, we could win, or you know, we could lose.
Well, he's right.
There's always the possibility of a tie.
We have four or five people on the show that are, you know, we're talking professors and so forth. And I have the hardest time, and they're all Trump supporters. Or, I don't know if they're Trump supporters so much, but they're anything but a Democrat. So no matter who was in there, Lucifer could be in there, and it'd be okay, as long as it wasn't a Democrat, which is kind of bizarre. Because we've had some pretty good Democrats. This whole thing with the tariffs, I can't get anybody to agree that this is a massive tax increase, very regressive. And Lou, nothing is more plain than me getting older than that being the truth. And I can't get any.
But you're okay. In the world of economics, I'm sure that's likely correct. But that's not the analytical model that people are saying you need to use on this.
Why?
Because they're not designed for revenue generation or anything else. They're designed as a negotiating ploy.
Why do you believe that?
I'm not saying no. Don't ascribe that belief to me. I'm just saying that this is the analytical tool that the Trump people are using, and the analytical tool that, or the analytical method that the president is looking at these from, has nothing to do with revenue generation or taxation or anything else. They are simply something that he can put down, a hammer that he can lay down to extract concessions, a deal, something.
What?
And that is his shtick.
And my question to you is a learned gentleman, is if I kicked you right in the ass and said I didn't really do it, I have an ulterior tremendous motive for doing that, so don't worry about it. Would you take that? This is the estimate.
Tom, if it doesn't go into effect,
what do you mean? They're already in effect.
Pardon me?
They're in effect.
No. If it doesn't go into effect, if it doesn't crash the economy, if it doesn't create this huge tax issue for people, that, you know, in terms of loss of revenue, then, you know, the good question about, you know, it's like whether a tree falling in the woods makes a noise. I mean,
this is the part I'm having trouble with, Lou.
I know.
Today, when something crosses the border, they're getting a check. Why does somebody say wait and see? It's happening as we speak.
Well, because the impact of it is not manifest yet on the economy.
Well, give it a month. I mean,
well, and that's the point. You're saying give it a month. So are we. So are the people.
What I'm saying is,
Trump.
But I'm stunned. I mean, I don't expect you to go through this crap like I do. The numbers they're talking about are far in excess the collections of the entire corporate tax they collect. How does somebody say it? It's no big deal. It's a massive big. It's the single biggest tax increase we've ever had in this country. It didn't go through Congress.
If in fact they stay in place long enough to have the impact that you and a number of other economists are saying they'll have, then you know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, I think people will say, yeah, that was a tax increase, and maybe it was a mistake.
I'm driving at the root of this, Lou. It's not the number. I happen to think the number won't be as big as they say it is either, but why is it how can I phrase this? Just what is it about this guy who does nothing but lie all day long that people believe him? What is it? Why, if somebody says, I'm using their estimate. Their estimate is $600 billion. That's what they said. I didn't say it. If you go to the debtclock.org, the number there is next year's anticipated tariff revenue. It's $670 billion. Last year it was 70. It's their number. What is it? Why is it your job to say, oh no, that's not the number. It really is not going to be anything. Well, it's not going to not be anything. I'm thinking it's going to be half of that. You know, it's not going to be 600. It's going to be 300. So I'm cutting them a break because I think their math is wrong. Okay, but the idea that oh no, don't worry about it. Your prices might not go up at all. Why is that your job to defend their own number? I don't get it.
I'm not. I don't know what your job means, but I'm just saying that most of the people that I listen to, who are, you know, on board with this thing, are not looking at it as a tax. Are not looking at it the way you're looking at it.
Well,
they're looking at it as a political lever, and they don't think it's going to have the impact that all the doomsayers are saying, because they don't believe that those things are going to be in place for long enough to have that impact. And I assume that's the reason why it's not getting the attention.
I think people
you're not seeing agreement with the economists.
I think somehow people other groups believe this guy in some regard. There's no chance that those numbers are going to go down to where they were before or below. Do you believe that? With this guy's been talking about tariffs since he was on Dick Cavett 40 years ago.
You're asking me to try to give you an explanation as to why people defend this. They defend it because they don't see them as the kinds of tax increases you do. They see them as negotiating plays, and they see them as a mechanism for crippling China, or at least damaging China in the short term. So that's why people are not overly excited.
And
about
I'm saying I don't understand.
I know, but let me just pitch this to you. As I said, Trump's superpower is getting people to reveal themselves. One of the biggest lies, cultural lies, if you will, that was perpetrated on the American people is that our expert class and our elites know what they're talking about. And this guy who's sitting in the White House right now has demonstrated over and over, not demonstrated, but has brought out over and over and over again the fact that the elites are wrong. They've got no special power, that in fact they are heavily compromised in their analysis by their self-interest. And so, you know, he comes at this from an angle of saying, yeah, I know all these economists say this stuff, but you don't have to listen to them.
Well, the economists don't run a meme shop out of the White House. He's selling hats in the front lawn. What people are willing to put up with here, I guess it's just a different generation.
Well, no, I don't think it's a different generation. I think what you're seeing is a significant portion of the population that's fed up, and said we're not going to listen to expertise anymore, because we don't believe expertise anymore.
I'm with you on that. I actually agree. I think you're absolutely correct on that. I'm just sort of stunned. I sent the thing out to everybody regarding the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and I don't want to go through it again, but it was a one-year fight in Congress, and now this hasn't even touched Congress. We had Hal Snar on yesterday. He was a brilliant man.
It will
when?
If it has the effect, if it starts hurting people's pocketbooks and these congressmen start looking at re-election.
But we had Hal Snar on yesterday, who's a brilliant economist, and he's like, well, Congress is, you know, essentially abdicated their role, so that means it's okay for the executive branch to be a dictator. And I'm going, whoa. They don't have a right to abdicate their role. That's what they're there for. I mean, I this whole thing, if you ask...
If they don't... So again, the superpower comes into play. If Congress will not get in the way of this, and Congress, I mean, what you're seeing, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I said one of the interesting things about this administration is that they've got lawyers who are doing now what the left, what the progressive side of our legal practice has done for decades, which is contort the language of statutes and twist things to give them as much leverage and power as possible and wait for somebody to tell them no. And this, you know, this is the result of Congress not doing its job, Tom.
Okay, you know, but I'm saying now you have a president who says I'm just going to ignore him.
We had a president who said I'm just going to ignore him last time too.
We've had guys that I agree with you. It's been somewhat of a regression. I think it probably started actually with the Cheney Rumsfeld duo that were pissed off.
No, it started. Way before
they were upset that Bush won, went to Congress. He didn't declare war, but he got permission for Gulf One. He went to Congress and at least informed him and told him what he was doing. And they were upset with him, saying he didn't have to do that. That the president, they were for the imperial presidency, not in the same way as this, but they were absolutely.
Let me ask you to hearken back to the days when Congress had the temerity to tell the president, "You can't employ U.S. military forces for more than 90 days without getting our approval in any capacity." Do you remember that?
I do.
That statute was called?
I don't remember.
Famous.
I don't remember. You got me on this one. I remember
it's called the War Powers Act.
Yeah. Okay.
It was passed during Reagan's administration. I wrote a law review article on it. And that statute significantly limits the ability of the president to commit U.S. military forces to combat.
So what did...
Not a single president, not one, has ever followed the requirements of that statute. Not Reagan, not Bush, not Clinton, not Obama, not Bush II.
Why?
Because they think they don't have to. And Congress has never had the intestinal fortitude, the testicular fortitude, to stand up and say, okay, we're exercising our options here.
How exactly would they do that? Well,
they would cut the funding off. The statute's very clear. If you don't get congressional authority to engage in this stuff, the funding for that operation stops.
All right, so we've got guys and girls now. Someplace at the 91st day, they don't eat dinner. They don't get any bullets.
Yeah, they don't get any bullets. That's exactly what happens.
But I mean, I'm not so sure they'd want to pull that one. That rabbit out of the hat.
You asked. Yes. Okay. So this goes then to your point. You know, why don't they do what they're supposed to do? Because they don't have the guts to do it. Some Congress could stand up and say, Mr. President, it's day 85. If you don't give us If we don't get a presentation from you that gives us the authorization or gives us the wherewithal to continue this and get a declaration of war from us or a declaration of something from us, then we are turning the spigot off to this military operation, and you can't fund it.
How did they ever get the money in the first to do it? You can get money for 90 days, or do you pull that money out of somewhere else?
They have an operation. DOD has an ops budget, an operational budget that they can run stuff out of.
Well, I'm not the attorney on this, but this
statute. You're asking why don't they do it? They don't do it in this case, in one of the most important things that a government does. That is declare war on other nations. We have a statute that says you have to get congressional approval before you do it for commit them for more than 90 days, and no president has ever followed it or has felt constrained by it.
Congress
has the mechanism to stop it, and they won't, and that carries through to all kinds of things.
I'm not a kid anymore. I'm getting up there, but I plan on being here for quite a while, nice and healthy and helping my clients and everything else. I don't know, the older I get, the more I read, the more I learn from you guys. Nothing in this world, with all our warts, Nothing in this world has been more important to the world, in my opinion, you know, maybe Greece or Rome or something, than the United States. With not all what we do, but what we stand for, I think is so damn unique that if we go down, or we cease to believe it, I don't know how many gazillion years it's going to take for the world to recover. Why doesn't everybody else feel like that? If all of a sudden we don't have a Congress that does anything, we got a guy in there who thinks he's a dictator, and whether you like him or don't, he feels he's a dictator. I mean, this idea of popping out a dictum every hour, Caesar wouldn't have done that, for God's sake. Now, whether or not it ends up, some of the ideas are pretty good. Yeah, some of them are, and some of them go after stuff like you're talking about. It's not like everything he says is wrong. It isn't. But we have a process here that I think the rest of the world is somewhat jealous of. And if we go down, if we say, oh, hell, we don't need any Congress anymore, we can have a banana republic dictator, or we can do something. Hell with that. It's too much trouble to have courts anymore. We know the guy's guilty.
Tom.
If we go down, I think the world's got a problem, not just us, Lord, just me.
Well, I agree, but I will tell you, we had a functional, a non-president for 4 years.
We had that with Reagan for 2 years.
No, we didn't.
It was close.
And I know you keep saying.
We surely
that,
did with Wilson.
I haven't seen. We certainly did with Wilson, and it was a constitutional disaster.
Oh yeah, it was.
And
yeah,
the
was.
World and the world was not as dangerous a place as it was when Mr. Potato Head, who just left office and who spoke the other day, when Mr. Potato Head was in office. And again, we don't know who was running the country. We still don't. Notwithstanding all the tell-all books, we don't know. So that's as much of a dictatorial kind of style as anything this guy's doing. What Trump is doing is what we have seen from progressive administrations for decades. They have looked at the statutes. They have looked at what Congress has authorized. They have looked at the language and said, we can do certain things up to a point, and we are going to do them to that point with our interpretation.
Well, okay, but I read something once where there was a legal scholar, you know, whatever that means. He was assessing the Constitution. This has to be 30 years ago. I was reading this a little, and I don't even remember who the hell was in office. And he said the biggest weakness in the Constitution, if you really look at it, is there is way too much power in the executive branch.
Didn't used to be.
Well, I'm saying, and he said the reason for that is all the people who were at the Constitutional Convention and wrote this together, they were worried about checks and balances all over the place, they weren't really too powerful in Congress. They all in their back of their mind knew that the president was going to be George Washington. And somehow or another, in this guy's opinion, somehow or another, they felt that every successive president would be George Washington. And they're not.
If you read the Federalist Papers, you know that's wrong, because they talk about the strong man concept in the Federalist Papers.
Right, okay, well, this guy's point was, if you really got somebody in there who pushed, there's not enough drag on him. If Congress and everybody else kind of falls behind, there's no drag behind it.
Okay, let me pitch something to you. The president has a particularly strong role. You know why? He is the only nationally elected element in the entire federal constitutional system. He's the only guy who has to get up in front of the American people and say, you know, elect me. And they do. He's a nationally elected figure. He's the only one. Everybody else is regional. And the judges, of course, are appointed in the federal system.
Okay.
So it makes perfect sense that you would give that guy, as the embodiment of the voice of the people, you would give him or her the levers to execute the laws that Congress passes. And yet his authority or her authority is heavily constrained by the fact that Congress can turn off the spigot to his operations anytime it wants.
How do you turn off the spigot to the meme coins that they're putting out and taking the biggest investors that are meme coins to huge us paying them the banquets and well, I think we're paying for them and tours of the White House. When's the last time we had anybody run a business out of the White House?
I don't. I'm not familiar with what that program is. I heard something about it yesterday, but I'm not familiar with what it is.
Well, I'm not so sure. It has to do with the Trump meme coin. There's 25 people that are up like $1 million a person, or way over $1 million, and 750,000 people have lost money in the thing.
Well, Congress can put a stop to that.
How?
They passed a law that says you can't do this, Mr. President.
He's going to say my son's doing it.
Well, in that case, then the Congress can say, okay, fine, we'll impeach you.
Well, I hope we don't go through that again, God bless.
Well, but the Congress has said no. Trust me, if the House shifts again, excuse me, if the House shifts again in a year and a half, you're going to see impeachment after impeachment directed at Donald Trump. If he remains as effective,
I don't want us to do that for 2 years, really.
If he remains as effective as he's been, you're going to see that, because he's driving people absolutely nuts, and this is another function, by the way, of congressional fortitude. A very popular president, a populist president like Donald Trump, scares the bejesus out of congressmen whose only job, Tom, whose only job is to get reelected. That's their job. That's what they see their job as. And so if your job is to get reelected and you've got a populist president, you want to hook onto those coattails.
Well, you just piled into my whole theme here this morning. Although nobody can ever figure out what my theme is.
Wait a minute. Wait, hold on. I was told there would be no themes.
Well, that's right.
Up to this point, there hasn't been, as far as I can tell.
I'm saying is the people I'm talking to lately, the thing that kind of scares me a little is they have zero respect for our system. Congress, screw them. Judges, if I don't agree with them, they were appointed by the wrong guy, get them the hell out of there, shoot them. This attitude.
We're not anywhere close to that.
I'm saying this attitude across the board, I'm hearing all over the place. All over the place. And I never. There's no. It's almost like every Catholic priest is a child abuser. It's like every congressman. And actually, the question I wanted to ask you seriously is why do. I'm going to say that. You and I, if we went to Congress, I don't know what aisle I'd be in the middle of the aisle, whatever. I don't know. I wouldn't be on either side. You'd be on one side, I know. Okay, but why would you and I, who I think have an amazing, even though we argue about everything, I would say that on a personal level, you and I agree on about 90% of the world. Why the hell, you as an attorney who I think has been straight as all get out, and I know when I was on the trading floor, I never had, nobody ever said for us a word that I ever ditched on a trade or anything like that or ever cheated, because I didn't. Why would you and I allow other attorneys or other traders screw up to the point where you and I get painted by the same brush? I would never let that happen, and I don't think you would either. Why does a guy like, I think, Mike Quigley, I think maybe Dick Durbin, these are people in Illinois, I think that, you know, they don't look to me like they're rich or anything like that, even Tammy Duckworth, whether you like her politics or not, why would they be in an institution where people are trading all day long and doing all this kind of crap and not saying, get these people the hell out of here because I don't want people judging me like that? Why does it not happen?
Well, okay, so the denigration of Congress is not a new phenomenon. You know, Mark Twain, remember him?
Yeah.
Said what, 150 years ago? America is unique in that it has no native criminal class except for Congress.
well, it's always been a joke, yeah. But
it's you know, those are jokes. Those are jokes.
But this trading thing, everybody's convinced now that every single congressperson is there to enrich themselves. And I'm saying at some point, somebody's going to say, "Hey," I looked at the we got to go to break here, but I went through the list 2 weeks ago. Lou, I don't think you were on. Some of these guys are making 4 and 5 and 10 trades a day. For God's sake, that's their full-time job. Anyway, we got to dash off the break. SP Futures up 56, and the NASDAQ Futures 258. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Craig Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 55. The NASDAQ futures up 258. We are rallying today. We were up yesterday and then a real lot in the morning. And then came, as the announcement was, that we were going to have trade talks with China, which is, I think, the thing that people are most focused on, and that was going to happen over in Europe. And as the day wore on yesterday, we ended up, you know, sneaking kind of, we were almost unchanged. And at times we were down and then we finished up some. But now today we're up again. We've got individual stocks. Goldman Sachs up 987. We've got JP Morgan up 286. So the banks are up a little bit. Nvidia's up 186. Apple's 198. It's still under 200 though. We got down to 196 yesterday. I was making a wonder if it was going to go down to 189 or wherever it traded a couple weeks ago, but it has not. So maybe it won't. Maybe we're going to rally back from here. Over in Europe, again, we're talking about this UK-US trade deal. The trade deficit is like, there isn't one. Matter of fact, one says we got a small deficit, and one other source says we have a small surplus. I don't get it. DAX up 268, was 1.1%. FTSE up 28.3%. CAC around up 85, 1.1. So the one that's not up so much is Britain, which is odd because that's where the deal is. A Nikkei up 148.4%. Hang Seng up 84.4%. Shanghai up 9.3%. So generally up over in Asia as well. We've got bonds up 3 basis points, 4.31. The bond up 2 basis points, 2.50. Oil, which is, again, now we're up to 59.06. Greg will probably talk a second at some point here. The low tick Monday morning was 55.50. Wow, that's $3.50 up from there. That's a lot. Brent up 91 cents, 62.03. Natural gas up 4 cents, 3.66. Gold, which was way up, and now it's heading south a little bit. Gold down $43, $33.48. It almost made it to $3,400 on Tuesday. We've got the foreign exchange. We got the euro, 1.1280. So the dollar is a little stronger. The British pound, same thing, 1.33. So kind of even there. Crypto up $3,300, $99,512. As we seems like Trump stocks, meme stocks go up. The fake stocks are going up huge here. Yesterday, as a way of review, the Dow was up 284. A lot of that was Disney. S&P ended up 24. This came on the last hour. NASDAQ only up 48. It was a dragger. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Good morning, everyone. 6:38 here in Chicago. We've got 47 degrees with a high of 52. Breezy, cooler in clouds tonight. Phoenix, 65 right now. Sunny, warm, high of 95. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from O'Hare, 21 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 25 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 25 minutes. The Ryan via the locals from 95th is 14 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 23 minutes. Sports. MLB Giants beat the Cubs again. That was at Wrigley, 3-1. White Sox lose at Royals. That was 1-2. NBA playoffs. Knicks beat the Celtics by 1. They're up 2-0.
You watch that game?
I missed that one.
I got a question for you, maybe that we can research while we're up.
Sure. OKC beat Denver. That was a beatdown, 149-106. The series tied 1-1 there.
87 points in the first half.
Yeah. And NHL, Leafs beat the Panthers at home. Toronto leads 2-0. Stars beat the Jets. Dallas leads 1-0. That's all I got, guys.
All right, I got a quick question for you. I hope I'm not getting senile. I don't think I am. Was it the Tooman night, which means judges and attorneys meet, but of course they picked the night where the Celtics ran at the Tripoli, so it was pretty loud. I was watching the beginning of the game. I seem to recall that the Knicks came down and scored a 3-point play, and they were up 3-0, and they were up 3-2. And all of a sudden, maybe 3 minutes later, there was a conclave of the refs, not the Cardinals, and all of a sudden, the Knicks didn't have any points. Then the Celtics were up 11-0, and I could swear that the first time down. Is there a reason why that 3 points came off the board that nobody seemed to know in the loud bar?
I can check the box score.
Yeah, something crazy happened. Hey, two things, Lou.
Let me just note before we track off on something. I want to just introduce something completely irrelevant, but significant for the culture. The new trailer for Grand Theft Auto dropped yesterday, or the day before.
New trailer
and has generated massive interest. And if you want to watch an entertaining and yet incredibly retro kind of presentation, go look up the trailer.
Really?
Have you ever played Grand Theft Auto?
People are saying that there's going to be World War III before Grand Theft Auto is released. It's like the running joke on the internet.
Yeah, because it's taken forever.
Right.
I mean, the first trailer dropped, 2 years ago?
Long time ago.
Yeah.
It's a big joke.
So, it dropped in 2023.
Is this a miniseries, a movie, or TV show? What is it?
It's a video game.
Oh, okay.
So Grand Theft Auto, the game itself draws its inspiration from Miami Vice.
I love that show.
Well, and then you have to watch the trailer because it's full of pastels and you know, really attractive women in short skirts or short dresses because it's got a Miami Vice party theme kind of thing going on. Lots of gunfire. I mean, it's astounding, and it's incredibly violent.
Has there ever been a TV show with better music?
Well, no, and I mean, I like to think that Miami Vice is brought the practice of taking popular music and inserting it into current TV shows to sort of the forefront. I mean, Glenn Frey, right, from the Eagles, he starred in a number of those episodes, or at least one of them, playing a drug smuggler.
So did Willie Nelson.
The song Smuggler's Blues was playing in the background. Anyway,
so did Willie Nelson start.
Grand Theft Auto trailer's got over 450 million views. It's like some record for a video game. And it, from a cultural perspective, if you're a gamer, this is a huge issue. It's supposed to come out next year, Greg?
We don't know.
Yeah, it's
we don't know.
Anyway, the trailer is highly entertaining.
All right, Lou, while you're here, this is the only person who'll know, India, Pakistan, what the hell?
Yeah.
Where's that going to go?
Do
they have an official demilitarized line like Korea?
No, it's called the line. Well, yeah, it's called the line of control, and it runs across through on the border of Kashmir, which is a disputed territory that India occupies but Pakistan claims. It's a big area. I'm always been amazed that there hasn't been a full fledged invasion by India of Pakistan, especially after the Mumbai massacre. You know, back in, what was it, 2008?
What's a little bit of the history? They were all somewhat together under British rule, and then India is...
Well, India and Pakistan were one country.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And it was a religious split after the British left, correct?
Right. So this is... People talk about Gandhi's being the great peacemaker, but this, you know... I mean, I don't know what, something 20-30 million people were massacred in the split. I mean, it was some incredible number. Basically, along religious lines, the Hindus and the Muslims separated, and now that doesn't mean there aren't Muslims in India. In fact, I think there's something like 200 million Muslims still living in India. But Pakistan became a separate country, comprised almost exclusively of Muslims. And what's, you know, that was a terrible, awful Civil War, violent split.
I seem to remember that when I was reconciled. And there have been a couple of real wars in the meantime. I seem to remember when I was in high school or college, there was one, right?
There have been legitimate fights over the border, but there hasn't been the kind of, you know, there hasn't been the kind of war of takeover that you see, you know, in like Ukraine. So the interesting point from our perspective is that for a long time, we sided with Pakistan. I mean, India tried to remain, quote, non-aligned, but it remained, which basically meant it remained a constitutional democracy, and it's the world's largest. But it tilted toward the Soviet Union. They got all their weapons from the Soviet Union. They did a lot of work with the Soviets and advisors and stuff like that, which probably explains why their country is still poverty stricken, and it's why Pakistan, it's a second world nation.
Fill me and the listeners. Pakistan, they're landlocked, right? Do they have any? What's their commerce? Do they have anything?
Minerals, and some agriculture, but we aligned with them. They aligned with us. India remained, quote, non-allied, but tilted toward the Soviet Union. We were selling weapons to Pakistan. We were sort of tied with their foreign policy. At the same time, a significant portion of the Pakistan government, especially their secret service, was tied very tightly to the Taliban. And to, there was a reason Osama bin Laden was hiding out in Pakistan. And so they have very close links to fundamentalist Islamic movements. Now, recently, within the last, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, and you know, the last 20 years or so, our, you know, embrace of Pakistan has faded, and our looking at India as a possible ally has increased for two reasons. Number one, the Indians have moved politically more into the Western sphere of influence. They're buying weapons from France and from other NATO countries, and there's the Russian stuff is still there, but you know, the Russians cut terrible deals in terms of trade. And also because India now is an anti-China, and they do not like the Chinese, and the Chinese have had some skirmishes with them on the border. Yeah, fought with them on the border several times. And so the Indians look at China as a problem. And so, you know, the enemy of our enemy is our friend. They've drifted more toward us.
How did they both get to be nuclear powers? I mean, when they say that they have a bomb, do they have a missile? I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, the Indians detonated a nuke back in, I believe, the mid-70s. Pakistan got nuclear technology, they think, and they think the Indians got their nuclear technology from the Soviets. They think Pakistan probably pirated their nuclear technology from the Indians, but they had help from North Korea the Pakistanis were giving assistance to North Korea, and also we think to Iran.
Do we think they have enough enriched uranium for a bomb? Do they have a missile?
The Pakistanis?
Yeah.
Nobody knows. We think they've detonated a nuclear weapon, but we've never seen it. You know, we've never seen an above ground test, for example. So the issue, you know, and both these countries they get into these fights, and you know, then they de-escalate. So we'll see if they de-escalate. I don't think India has struck as deeply inside Pakistan as with its military forces as it did the other night. On the other hand, you know, I think you can make a pretty good case that Pakistan has been funding Islamic terrorism in India for decades, and I, as I said, after Mumbai, I was amazed that the Indians did not just basically say, "We're taking Kashmir, and we're going to take some of this stuff."
Explain what the hell Kashmir exactly is. Is it like a province in the middle or a country in the middle? Who are they?
No, it's a sweater.
A sweater.
Let that sink in. No, it's a.
I understand that part.
They're fighting over a sweater. They want to take it's a region in northwest India that is, I think, most predominantly Muslim, but the Indians claim it as part of their area of influence.
Okay.
The Pakistanis claim it's theirs. The Indians have military control over the region. The Pakistanis dispute that, and every now and then you'll get some Pakistani inspired uprising there where people will attack.
Well, the actual border where India borders Pakistan, is it, you know, a barbed wire? Is it a mountain range? What is it?
It's a you know, fenced frontier like you had in Eastern Europe.
Oh, it's like Eastern Europe. It's a
I don't think there's a Berlin Wall up there, but it's a fenced frontier.
Okay, so it's not just an area that's just all mountains or anything. They say we're the other side and you're this side type of thing.
I mean, there may be that. I can't tell you exactly what that frontier looks like, but
the people who live next door to Audrey are from India. Got to talk about the nicest people. They're from Southern. They're all Catholic.
I think that's probably correct.
So there's Hindus, there's Catholics, there's Muslims, and probably something of everything. There's got to be Church of England there too, right? With those guys were there.
I'm sure there is. You know, the area you get, they're the most. I think they are now the most populous country in the world.
I think so too. Right?
1.4 billion.
One of the ladies that works at the Tripoli, and good friend of mine actually. She's one of these ladies that. Her boyfriend won't go. She goes like all over the world to these places, just wants to see him. And she was supposed to go to India with somebody from India, and I don't know if the person backed out, so she went by herself. She goes, there were cities. She goes, she's not afraid of anything. She goes, I'm just walking down the street, and there's so many people so close to you. I just went to my hotel and I left the next day. It felt so weird. That you're just walking down the street, and people are like almost so close to you. They're rubbing. It's like what you see in a street in Hong Kong or something. I just felt so uncomfortable.
It's very crowded, and they have all kinds of interesting cultural issues. We actually, when I was working in Italy, we were actually looking at. Going into India and doing work there because they had a large number of old fading weapon systems that needed 3D printed parts. And if you read about the culture and the history, it's remarkable. There are tens of millions of highly educated, brilliant Indian engineers and college grads and everything else. But they're not enough to sustain that economy, and it struggles.
Not to go down in the gutter here, but don't like 300 million people in the country essentially poop outside. Some huge number is that. There's nowhere near as many toilets as there are people.
I think it's it's not just. The availability of toilets, it's a cultural thing.
Yes, I'm saying, you're not supposed to do it in the house.
I think it's some incredible number, like 30% of the population.
Yeah,
it's which weird. Is what 1.3 billion is what 300, you know,
right, 400 right about million my people. Number.
Yeah, and so you have that issue. You've got the dietary issues with respect to eating, protein. There are a whole bunch of things, and so you've got a significant cultural push, very much like the Philippines, of saying, to get ahead, you got to get out of the country. And
these people that live next to Odd, and I mean they are doctor. I think they're both doctors. The kid just got accepted at like 5 medical schools. Go figure. They talk about the nicest people that ever walked. And boy, if you're their friend, man, you're their friend. And they're all Catholic. They're from Southern India. They're all Catholic. Hey, I read something interesting about the. We're kind of skipping all over a little bit. I know you're good at everything. But about the Pope's thing, the conclave.
Yes.
And I was reading this thing yesterday. Again, I just read this stuff. I don't draw conclusions from it, but I learned from every article. There's some fact in there that I don't know. That's why I read both sides, left and right, because somewhere in there there's something you learn from, and the rest of it's all kind of weird, right? Some kind of wacky conclusion. But they said every conclave, or this one guy said, every conclave is really a judgment on the last pope's reign, or whatever you want to call it. Said if you like what Pope Francis was doing, which is essentially a reasonably liberal, inclusive sort of attitude toward the Catholic religion, this guy's the obvious choice. And if you think that was a huge mistake and we got to go back to the all kinds of rules and blah, 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 this guy's the obvious choice. And if you're somewhere in the middle, you like what Francis did, maybe he went a bit too far and could come back a little bit, the guy in the middle is this guy. I'm sitting there reading this. I go, Lou would really understand this, I'll bet. Is it? You think that's true?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah, because they come in and first of all, the Pope, previous Pope, has, you know, appointed a number of these bishops or cardinals.
Big majority of them.
These guys come in, and you know, do we owe this guy and his memory something? Alternatively, and I assume that you don't get to be a cardinal in the Catholic Church without having some personal ambition. I assume that there are people saying, okay, this guy, I owe something to my predecessor who appointed me, but you know, he's up in heaven and he's not talking to me. I haven't heard from him lately. So I can do whatever I want here. I can move my own, advance my own interest. I find it. I'll be very interested to see what rolls.
You remember Cardinal Bernardine? You were here when he was here, right?
Yes.
I thought he was just an exceptional person. I think he could have been first American Pope, but he died young of cancer. You know, the day he was made a cardinal, he called his mother. You know what she told him? Don't let it go to your head.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
there's an old fashioned mom, huh?
Do you remember the novel and the movie The Shoes of the Fisherman?
Yeah, I think I saw part of the movie, but it was a long time ago.
Movie's great, but it's I think a much better movie about the selection of the Pope than Conclave, which just came out and had a woke political message that it wanted to impart. But I'm operating on you know, the assumption that what we're going to see, I think, will not be another Latin American or even American, you know, North or South American Pope. But
if the guy, if you like his style, the obvious choice is an Italian, according to what I read.
Yeah, I mean, if you're embracing, you know, liberation theology and some of the other stuff that Francis embraced, then that's fine. I would, if they're taking the temperature in Rome, in the Vatican City. I shouldn't call it Rome; it's the Vatican City. It's a separate country. If they're taking the temperature in the Vatican City, I would think they would look to swing the pendulum back a little bit, because what you're seeing here in the United States and in a number of other countries with large Catholic populations is a move back to more traditional Catholic practices. I mean, do you have in Chicago, I think you do, a Latin Mass movement?
No, that guy, didn't they excommunicate him with fever? Well, you know, explain this a little bit of a story. I was at a first communion last Saturday, my nephew's daughter, and a lot of it had to do with logistics, but I had my first communion in the same place, okay, but there was 162 kids, and by the way, the place was half as big as it is now, so it was just a logistics problem just to get it done, right? Well, this time, all 80 kids participated in the Mass. They read all the scriptures, they read all the epistles. I mean, they didn't do the stuff the priest has to do, but all the, you know, the pray for this guy, pray for that guy, they did all of that. And all of the 80 kids got to say something in front of the mic. And they were damn good at it. And I think stuff like that is, compared to the, you know, the old Latin Mass, I think the participatory sort of stuff, getting people involved, to a certain degree, is really positive. I don't know.
You know who you have to thank for that, right?
John the 23rd.
Yep. It's always a pleasure. You know, Tom, it is a real pleasure talking with you about this stuff, because I was raised Catholic, and I'm sorry to say I've lapsed, but I did attend Mass at Easter in our local Catholic church here in Denver, and I found that I slipped right back into, impressed with the ceremony and impressed with the tradition and everything else. So it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Yes,
I am
John Paul the 23rd.
This is weird because sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about and wish I did. I'm actually really up on this. The reason why I am, the pastor at St. John Fisher was a guy named Father Cain, the skinny, grumpy old guy. All he ever did was work. He had three priests there. The place had we had four classes of over 40 kids in every grade. It's a huge parish, and he supervised the doubling of the size of the church. Everybody pledged. He took the pledge stuff, went to the bank, got a loan, built the place. Everybody paid up, and it was all done, taken care of, paid cash. And he to look at him, you'd have sworn he was, somebody from the Dark Ages. In fact, he was one of the most liberal dudes. When they put this church together, they put an altar in there because he anticipated that the priest was going to now face you versus turn around. Look at those big altars. So the altar is this big granite altar that was put in the middle, so for a while they could have the old Latin Mass, and then when he anticipated what the council was going to do, and then you could just walk around the other side of the altar and do the other thing. He was right on the cusp of this, and all the nuns and everybody taught that when we were in grammar school, that this was the old church, this is the new church, and you're supposed to get involved. You're supposed to know what they're saying, not Latin, and it was a massive deal in our church.
I'm going to drop off here because I'm up with my hour, but I will tell you this: if they're taking the temperature in Rome, what you're seeing here in the United States is a drift. Not a huge movement, but a drift back to some more traditional practices, including the use of the Latin Mass, which I'm not opposed to if the congregation is impressed with it. And part of that, Tom, is driven by Catholic schools, which have become more and more important as our public school system has fallen apart, especially in places like Chicago.
Next week, let's talk about this charter school thing in the Supreme Court.
Okay.
If that's going to affect regular Catholic schools, it looks to me like it might. Now, I'm not the attorney.
Oh, I think it will. I think if they rule that you can fund them, then I think Catholic schools step up immediately.
Well, if you got 30 seconds, the other guys, I'll ask them when they come back because they like to listen. What is now stopping a place like St. John Fisher saying we are now a charter school, and oh, by the way, all the religion classes are going to be voluntary and they're going to be held in this other building. Why now are they stopped?
They're stopped in Chicago because of the Chicago Teachers Union.
I get that, but I'm saying why legally are they stopped?
Legally they are. The argument is that to the extent these are charter schools and being funded by the state, this evidence is a state supported of religion, which the Constitution prohibits. And under Supreme Court interpretation, I think that interpretation is wrong, and it may be corrected here by this Supreme Court. But that's the argument.
Well, you do know how the charter schools work here, how they're funded. I mean, I'm not the whole detail, but what happens, and it's actually very similar to the schools in Canada. If you and I want to open up a charter school, the building and all the plant equipment is on us, but if a student shows up, he gets the 20 grand, he or she gets the 20 grand that follows that student to the Chicago Public Schools. Chicago Public Schools has like a separate budget. One is for the plant and equipment, and one is if 1,000 kids show up at your school on Labor Day, that's why I always try and get everybody out the first day, you get 20,000 times 1,000 kids. That's your budget for the place.
Yeah.
That money follows you to the charter school. I don't think the plant and equipment money does. Am I correct on this, you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's done differently in each state,
okay.
But the idea is that the state is paying for this is is akin to supposedly establishing a religion.
Well, I did first grade, half of first grade in Canada. And up there, if you were a Catholic school that was accredited, your education allowance, the part for that kid of, out of the taxation, followed you wherever you went.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are a number of states that have done that. So.
Well, Canada, well, our 51st state, according to Trump. Lou, take care of yourself, buddy.
All right.
SP Futures up 52, NASDAQ Futures up 250. Greg, you want to go right to our guys? Greg, are you there?
I'm here.
You want to go right to our guys?
Everyone's here.
All right. Hey, gentlemen, I don't know if you're listening to the last parts of that. Do you have any, if you are, you got any comments? Are we going to have a big war in India-Pakistan, or are one of you guys going to sneak in and be the compromise? You don't have to be a priest to be pope, you know.
That's true, but, I, you know, we have a guy in the White House who thought he should be pope and sent out that AI-generated image with him dressed as the pope. Everyone's looking for white smoke over at St. Peter's today. I wonder what they would think if orange smoke comes out of the chimney.
Did you see that they take the chimney down between these things? You know that? I mean, they don't.
Right.
Why is that?
Also, right next to the chimney, a pair of seagulls. A family of seagulls, because they have their chick up there, and they're right next to that chimney.
Well, they had the firemen up there. Really, there's a hole in the roof, and then they must plug the hole to the next time, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, except in 1978. You know, there were two conclaves within very
close
that. Proximity to one another.
The guy lasted what, 6 weeks?
33 days. If you're into Masonic conspiracies,
I would let me see if I can remember the two guys' names.
That was John Paul the First, and then he was succeeded by John Paul the Second.
That's
and,
right.
And of course, John Paul the First succeeded Pope Paul the Sixth.
Yeah, Paul VI came after John the 23rd, right?
John the 23rd, right. And there's a funny story. You know, it's funny how the media only pays attention to the Catholic Church when there's a a selection for a new pope. They bring out all these details, but John the 23rd, you know, they have in what they call the Room of Tears, which is a very small room where the selectee goes into to, you know, make the final decision after he's elected, whether he's going to take on being the pope. They have three vestments for the pope, a small size, medium size, and a large size. And that's because back when John the 23rd was selected, he tried to put on the vestments, and he was too fat.
You might need a couple X's in there.
Yeah, they had to bring in a tailor from Rome and had to widen the vestments for him.
Well, from my way distant memory, it seems to me that when John the 23rd was picked, he was like an older guy, a compromise candidate, because they couldn't pick a guy. They figured, we'll put this old fart in there. He won't do anything for a few years. He'll croak, and then we'll pick a guy.
Yeah, he got in there
and said, "Well, I'm not dead yet," and he ended up having the first council in like 200 years. He was a dynamo, even though he was older.
Oh yeah. He the Vatican II, really was the first attempt to modernize the church.
Yeah. Do we have Andrew?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you, bud?
Pretty good. Thanks. And I thought I'd go back to your question about the schools.
Yeah.
In part to show that I'm listening to the previous segment, but also there's some relevant history that Wayne also knows about, thanks to our very devout Catholic mentor here in Washington from some years ago, who used to bring us to... the Red Mass at cathedral here in
St. Matthew's.
St. Matthew's, that's where, of course, this ceremony, funeral mass for JFK was famously held. But here's the relevant part of history, is this big legal blessing of the Supreme Court and other lawyers to do good works during the year, first Sunday of October, is organized by the John Carroll Society. And to get to the point, John Carroll was a Roman Catholic founding father who installed into the Constitution the provision that we're talking about here, separation of church and state. And the reason was, as a Roman Catholic, in fact, he was the first Roman Catholic archbishop in North America later, he realized that it was a minority. And so if we don't have separation of church and states, the minority Roman Catholics will be overwhelmed. And they were able to get that into the Constitution. So there's a great irony that it's being challenged these days in the ways that you were describing.
Well, it's getting blurred all over. Well, let's take it both directions. But here it gets down to like some numbers. In Chicago, I'm going to say at one point the Catholic school system was never as big as a public school system, but let's say it was three quarters as big, something like that. And you know, where everybody's paying taxes, and the separation is everybody's paying tuition at the Catholic schools. You know, they're totally separately funded. And a lot of people would say that's the way it ought to be. Okay, well, that's fine. But when it gets to the point where the Mayor Daley too, who I used to talk at the health club all the time, I won't say we were friends, but we certainly were acquaintances, and we would talk, and I said, Mayor, and all of a sudden some of these Catholic schools started to close, which means the kids either are going to go to a close Catholic school, maybe, or maybe they're closing because people can't afford it, and they're going to go into the public schools, which means that the burden on the taxpayer is going to go up, correct? So I said, Mayor, if you could find a way to keep some of these schools open, how much money are you talking about? He goes, I think the three or four that just closed, if you could get them $500 a year per student, they could make it, certainly $1,000. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. We're going to let schools close and pour 100 kids into the public school system, where the number there at that time was probably 10 grand a kid, instead of finding a way to pitch the Catholic school 500 to 1,000 and keep them open. Is there anything, you ever heard anything more stupid than that on a numbers basis?
Well, I think the issue is that this isn't unique to Chicago.
No.
I mean, we see a lot of, I'm from the Philadelphia area, and we used to have quite a few Catholic schools in the city, but you know, the city started to change demographically, and with the, it was white flight to the suburbs, and these Catholic schools in the city started to hurt, and I know of quite a few have closed down, so I think there's a lot of things that go into this.
But the parish where I didn't grow up in, but we ended up in, they closed, and now the one just to the north of there closed. But I question, you know, what the church's motivation is. I'm going to guess that there's still more people in the parish that are Catholic than there were there the day it opened. Maybe.
Right.
So I don't know. And what's before we get into the Washington stuff and the, I started the show, I can't figure out, and CNBC says we have a trade deficit with Britain, and then I went to this other site, and we got a surplus with them. In any case, it's pretty damn even. So what's the big politics about Britain? It's almost like even. Let's say it's even.
You want to take a stab at that, Andy? Because the big announcement is not far from you today.
Well, I think putting aside these deficits, which there's a question whether that's a real figure that everybody should be focused on. But to get to the politics, the new Labour government came in last year, immediately got into kind of a scandal, but they're also facing a very rough economy there. And so they really want a quote-unquote deal to kind of shake things up and show the voters that they were right and getting rid of the Conservatives over there. So I think they've got a political motivation to work out something with the Trump administration. And of course, the Trump administration, more than 30 days after announcing that we're going to do a deal-a-rama with 200 nations for the next 90 days, really wants a trophy, a deal, whatever it is. So that's coming down the pike today.
Have you ever heard of these guys, the World Population Review?
I know about it. I'm not sure I've ever read one of their periodicals.
Well, they've got this. If you look at deficits, they got a U.S. deficit with every country, right? And way down the page here is United Kingdom, and they've got us importing $62 billion and us exporting $72 billion, which is slightly different than the CNBC's number. So say it's within $10 billion either way. What's the need for some huge deal? What's the problem?
Yeah, it sounds like everybody over here is getting all the scotch they need.
Yeah, I mean it's a toss up. What needs to happen here?
Yeah, I think you know, like Annie said, both governments are looking for something that they can point to, especially after what happened with the visit of the Canadian Prime Minister this week. There was absolutely no deal, and apparently that we saw some of it so on TV. But the government of Keir Starmer in the UK, they're being also pulled by some in their own party, the anti-Brexiteers. To try to get a backdoor, maybe associate membership in the European Union, and there's that going on too. There's a thought that the Prime Minister of the UK cannot deal with some on his right without doing a deal with the United States because the Brexit people are still strong. As a matter of fact, the Reform Party, which is the old Brexit Party, scored very big last week in the local elections for municipal and county councils. So he's walking a fine line. He's got to show them, look, I'm doing this deal with Trump, your friend. He's, you know, the Reform Party is Nigel Farage, who's I think at Mar-a-Lago more than he is in his own constituency in the UK, and also then placate the people that want closer ties with the EU.
Well, I mean, if you look at this list of all these numbers, and you can sort of gather, I've got Canada trade deficit. Now, what is, again, you know, this is my numbers mentality, which is both a blessing and a curse. If you look at the numbers, is it the actual number or is it the percentage? I mean, like right now I'm looking at Canada. Well, Canada's got a $52 billion, where are we here? Sorry, where the hell, I seem to have lost it there. Here we go. We got a $54 billion deficit. Okay, but we've got $377 in imports and $322 in exports. So, I mean, 50, yeah. You know, so 54 is less than 10% of the total back and forth. Where some places, I mean, we're buying like everything from there. I mean, if you go down the list here, I mean, some of them are like Switzerland. you know, we import or we import 49 and export 23 billion, which has got to be all watches, right? I would think.
Right. God
knows, what else? Well, I mean, so that the percentage there is a lot bigger. Italy the same way. I mean, obviously we're buying pasta. You know, we're importing 69 billion and exporting 30. So that's way more than 2 to 1. You know, so that's like a $40 billion deficit on $100 billion total. Well, I would say if there's a problem, if you think it's a problem, that's a bigger problem than Canada, because Canada is only 10% of the back and
right.
forth.
Right. We heard in the Oval Office that Trump said we don't need Canadian lumber, we don't need Canadian steel, Canadian aluminum, and
energy,
and
energy.
And yeah. Energy, right. And the Canadian, and then Trump says to the Prime Minister Carney, he says, we don't have any business going on really of any import with Canada. And you know, the Canadian Prime Minister is looking at him like, what, we're your largest trading partner.
Well, there's been a lot of the part that, I mean, I say this every day. I don't know if it makes me popular. Probably doesn't, especially with the Trumpers. But I see people that are a lot smarter, in my opinion, than somehow they're letting Trump define their issues. It's one thing whether you agree with somebody or you don't. It's quite another to have somebody define only the things you argue about. You know,
well, and one of the factors is they brought in a Greek chorus at the press club, not the press club, the White House press office, of basically a chorus that will approve whatever the announcements are, and kind of lowered the abilities and profile of places like Associated Press, Reuters, Bloomberg, to ask follow-up questions. And as part of that, to go back to one of your earlier points a moment ago, here we got a trade deal that's going to be announced. For the listeners, in evaluating your media, I would suggest a focus on one factoid. Does the news report say that this has been years in the making? In my understanding, it has been. And we talked just a moment ago about both UK and US want the announcement of a deal, which the implication is US and UK nationwide deal. But the reason it takes years to negotiate is they're talking about specific products and services. And I don't think either side wants to talk about a years-long process. They want to make it look like their new governments achieved something spectacular today.
Oh, it's all about them. You guys, don't take this wrong. You could be the only two guys I know that actually have looked at the details of a tariff agreement. don't take this wrong. Doesn't mean you don't have five girlfriends on the side you could rather spend your time with or play golf. But when he was in office originally and they started talking about trade stuff with Canada, there's a place somewhere on the internet. I mean, where the entire book of tariffs, Book of Mormon, Book of Tariffs, is like printed. And I dug in there and I just went to, it's like 1,000 pages long or something. So I scrambled forward the page, you know, like 415, just to get in the middle of it. I got on the page regarding cottage cheese. And I'm sitting there looking at this and going, less than 1% milk fat, small curd, over 2% milk. And I'm going, and every one of them had a number with it. Or didn't have a number with it. When some of them were free, some of them weren't. I'm sitting there going, how many bleeps spent time lobbyists? Every one of these lines must mean something to somebody, whoever the hell that somebody is. this thing is so complicated. You know, for two jamokes to get in the White House and say, we cut a deal this morning, it's so bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean,
And it's you know, when there used to be trade deals, I probably going back to the days when there was the GATT agreement before the World Trade Organization, countries would announce what they called omnibus trade deals, which were across the board, right, on everything. And like Andy said, this one with the UK is very targeted, and they're going to make it sound like it's an omnibus trade package, but it's not. And
but it doesn't look like there's enough there to argue about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is this issue in the UK. I forgot to mention that people, especially in the Labour Party, but also in the opposition Liberal Democratic Party, not so much in Conservative Party, that they're opposed to any attempt to for us to sell UK food products, for example, what they call chlorinated chicken, because chicken in this country, it's legal to basically wash chicken for, you know, obvious health reasons in chlorine, but they don't want any part of that over there.
How much of that? They also don't want some of the GMO grain and so forth. How much of that is, you know, for real, and how much of it is just they don't want our stuff? I mean,
well, you know, a lot of it is, if you're talking about like Monsanto, for example, a lot of their seeds are GMO, and they don't want any part of sending any sort of produce over there, or the Monsanto, you know, Monsanto keeps a license on their seeds.
Yeah,
and they've been known to take people to court and financially ruin.
If you have a farm and the seeds blow over to the next guy's farm, and I mean they'll sue the guy. I don't care if it's a Monsanto farm. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Plus you can't use the seed from your last year's crop for your next year's crop. You got to buy it again from them.
Yeah, I mean, it's worse than royalties for music and film.
Well, you two dudes, and don't take this like a shot, or like me, you've been around a while, okay? And when all this world trade stuff started, it's been trade since the Vikings traded, and God knows where the first people in the round traded. But when all this stuff sort of started, where it became bigger and bigger as you got more and more ships and everything, the economists of the world, and I use the term Milton Friedman because he was a leader in this, is that you'd want all as much free trade as you could, because even if you had trade with a country that had a lousy government, if economics got better and economic freedom were to get there and times got better, they, like the U.S. and Europe, would figure out a way to get rid of the crummy government and have that basically political freedom would follow economic freedom, was their mantra. And at the time, it seemingly made sense. They had, examples like the U.S., like Europe, they had places. And over a period of time now, I mean, Trump is not wrong. But he wasn't the first, that he's not wrong to say something's wrong with this China deal. And we have a gentleman on the show, Carl Denninger, who always... I guess I could have thought of it myself, but I didn't. He says basically it's reached the point where big companies are offloading child labor and pollution to other places and competing essentially illegally with places that are here. I mean, some of it is just comparative advantage. They got more people, we got more power. I could do the economic analysis on comparative advantage. I used to be able to anyway. But the idea that our companies are paying off politicians in China to keep their thumb on the neck of the population certainly was not in Milton Friedman's theorem on the board, right? Yet it seems like it has happened. So we've got this problem with China. And oh, by the way, they're using some of the money to build a lot of weapons, maybe to kick our ass someday, which is a little bit of a problem on top of it. So we've got this issue. and we got a guy comes into the White House who recognizes, I think, that issue. Yet he's got this thing up his behind about tariffs so much that he kind of blows at him with this tariff sort of thing. I think that there is a problem with China and maybe some of the other places. We really don't want labor laws here saying you can't work under 16, and yet we can buy all the stuff you want at some place where they're working when they're 8 and competing against people here who follow some decency. Now, I don't think tariffs are necessarily the solution. They may work. I hope maybe they'll do something, but I don't hear anything in Trump's, you know, cockadoodle doing like a rooster, saying that we're really fighting against labor laws, we're really fighting against... He's fighting against his gross idea of they're stealing from us because there's a deficit. Is there another way to do it? Is there some way you could say, unless you have child labor laws that are enforced under 16, we're not trading it at all? Is there some other way to get to where we want to go without tariffs?
Yeah, well, you're not going to get that from this administration, and because you got a lot of Republican governors, like including our governor down here in Florida, DeSantis, who's they want kids out working on the farms now down to as young as 14, because of course all the migrant workers that were working here have been either chased out or picked up by ICE and deported. And, you know, there's so many other factors. It's almost like what, you know, when Colin Powell belatedly said, you know, it's the pottery barn rule. If you break it, you buy it, you own it.
Yeah.
He was talking about the Iraq invasion, of course, which he participated in. But I have a feeling like people came in. The economy was coming back with Biden. You know, we came out of a terrible pandemic, and now, you know, yeah, there were areas that could be tweaked, but I think they decided we're just going to break it. But they don't want to own it. They've broken it. They don't want to own it.
Yeah, I don't. Well, go ahead, Andy.
Oh, I was going to say there's a fundamental contradiction between the idea. We're going to impose these huge tariffs to get the business community to build factories here and then say, oh, we're going to make 200 deals in the next 90 days to resolve these tariffs country by country. And, you know, you've talked about it for weeks on the show, but the fundamental contradiction doesn't go away. Of how are people supposed to invest, including the farmers trying to buy their seed corn here in the spring, or actually earlier, how are they supposed to invest in the supposed goal of putting the tariffs for investments here if they don't know what's going to happen on the so-called deals every day?
Well, let's go to break and let's expand on that, because from Chicago, you guys have been here enough to know. I'm going to ask, a couple of guys the last couple of days, what exactly, when you say we're bringing all this stuff back, does anybody want to do that? And what are the barriers to it? SP Futures up 52, NASDAQ Futures up 261. You're right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Low and back stocks and jacks. I'm talking about Rick Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 51, NASDAQ futures up 258. I'm going to do a real quick traffic, weather, sports. None of the rest of this stuff has changed since the last time we did on my end here. So we want to comment a little bit on what's going on with oil, will you, Greg, before we go back to the regular guys. And you want to do a little quick traffic, weather, do that.
What happened with oil was OPEC decided to put the squeeze on a couple of the countries that were not complying to date with what they wanted to do in terms of supply. So they're actually releasing more. They forecast a little bit
Greg,
more.
Greg, were those countries you're talking about, are they in the OPEC Plus?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And now they're saying we see enough demand, so we're going to actually release the amount that we had planned on before. And so what we saw was not panic, but a readjustment in the futures going out all the way into, I want to say, 6 months in the future, to where they're saying we're gonna release more barrels and not flood the supply, but increase the supply. So traders kind of panicked and sold the futures.
And now we're kind of right back almost to where we were before the announcement, right?
Right. And that was actually, I think, what price they were really looking to sell. So everybody who got short or panicked out, wrong decision.
Yeah,
surprise,
so
surprise.
Did you buy the low at 55.50?
The people with the most research and the most insights on it, they actually were right.
Imagine
but
that, huh?
You never know.
Did you find out what happened to the 3 points in the Knick game?
No. There was nothing in the box score that I saw that was reversed.
Well, let's just go right to the dudes then, because we had some interesting stuff. Guys, I was in, I'm sure you probably, since I mentioned it all the time, in previous life I worked at Pullman and we made railroad cars. Well, Pullman did a lot of stuff, but I was in the passenger division. When I was there, we were just finishing up the R-46 contract for New York, and we were deeply embroiled with the Amtrak contract, which became kind of a fiasco, but I was involved in the New York, Boston MBTA push-pull commuter cars, which we ended up selling 60 of those. And so I got really to go with a contract from almost day one to the end. So it was quite the learning experience. I was the financial manager on it and so forth. And Pullman, it was the oldest company on the New York Stock Exchange. They had three generation people that have worked in Pullman. And a lot of these guys really just love their jobs. The manufacturing engineers. I mean, railroading can get into your blood. I mean, I loved it. I mean, I'd still be working there if they didn't. When you see a hunk of rolled steel come in the door, and 8 weeks later some gorgeous railroad car goes out, or 12 weeks, there's a feeling of accomplishment like building buildings or something. I mean, you know that. I won't say as males know that, females know that too. I mean, there's a sense of accomplishment in something like that. And Chicago used to be all like that. I mean, there were places that you made water heaters, you made this, you made all kinds of stuff. And, well, they even had the Ford plant down on Torrance Avenue. And little by little, as I've gotten older, no sets of parents, and it's not just because nobody wants to get dirty at work. All these places, in the end, Pullman didn't screw anybody, really, but they laid everybody off. And all of a sudden, you're a welder for 20 years. Now what the hell do you do when you're out of work? I mean, the idea that this is not, and Andrew, you brought it up very intelligently before the break. What's it going to take if we bring back some of this stuff, which I think we should? What's it going to take to give people the confidence that this might actually be a career for somebody and not just a one-year job where you learn something? And because the taste in Chicago of these people leaving, some of them screwing people out of their pensions, people stealing the pensions, nobody getting their stuff, and being on the government pension plan and not having a job from age 58 to 65 because nobody needed a welder anymore or a manufacturing engineer. How long, if ever, is that? I don't think the guy in the White House has any idea what I'm talking about. Is that taste going to leave? And Andrew, you brought it up there. You're not going to do it if you tell somebody to go borrow the money and a week later get rid of the tariff. I mean, how does the mentality come back to where we're anxious to do something like this? And some kid says, that is my career.
Well, let me pull together a couple of things here for a second. First of all, I was talking about the business person, because, of course, the show's theme, the farmer who's got to buy seed corn, a business executive trying to decide whether to order products internationally, build a factory. But what you talked about is the individual person, the person, young person trying to decide on a career. And what I've had about five different careers, and I loved them all, but each one met a change in the road that I had to adapt to. And it's got to be really tough for young people coming up these days. And here's one bit of obscure knowledge that goes to your Pullman description, Tom. I'm going to a college reunion now, and I recall, in a couple of weeks, I recall reading a book that was called The First Sociological Book Ever, which was in the 1800s, and it was by a Swedish person, a pioneer in sociology, and it was called Suicide, and he charted what was the happiest and most respected profession, or job, actually, that people wouldn't want to kill themselves because they were so happy. And it was railroad engineer. And because it combined physical labor with prestige in the community. And so that's a little factoid. And then what happened in the late 1800s? You had all these mergers and the start of panics, and ultimately by the 1950s, the American railroad industry was in big trouble, as I understand it. Please correct me on the timing.
Without a doubt.
But so, at any rate, if you're in the 1870s, you want to be a railroad worker, an engineer, maybe not laying tracks so much. But and then for larger reasons, it kind of disappears, or it's more difficult.
Well, there was some very fundamental issues with how, maybe we can talk about this someday, because it's pretty fascinating. Every dirty trick in business, everything you see anybody do, anything to do with slave labor, pretty much, anything you do, all you have to do is read the history of railroads, and it's all right there. It's right there. The first corporation, I think, might have... One of the first corporations was the Union Pacific, right?
Yeah.
And the two corporations coming, one going from Omaha west was the Union Pacific, and the one coming this way was the Central Pacific. And the first thing, not the first thing, that the people in the Central Pacific did was put up a separate, and I think the Union Pacific might have done it as well, put up a separate corporation that they actually hired. With the shareholders now were the executives of the first place, not the original shareholders, and they started paying this other corporation to actually do the track laying, where that place made all the money and the first place got bankrupted, but the people who were high up the chain in the Union Pacific made all the money and the original investors went down. Does that sound like that? Were the guys the energy company did the same thing, no one under. Does that sound
Enron?
Yeah, does that sound like Enron?
By the way, I just read that one of the leading financial people from Enron is, I think, going to be appointed to a high position.
It's Social Security Administrator.
Well, what could go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's all, it's the same thing. Well, we're making the money here. How about we do a little side business and we essentially, you know, we're getting money to run a jail. How about the three of us getting a business to launder the linens and pay ourselves like way more than we're supposed to, and bleed the money out of the jail into us. This is not.
I want the linen. I want the laundry contract for the reopened Alcatraz.
I don't think I want to be the laundress, though. But if there's something worse than you described, Tom, it's what happened in Pennsylvania about 10 years ago, where they were bribing judges to sentence more kids to prison because I guess it was a for-profit prison. And so they're paying off judges to take borderline juvenile delinquents and sentence them to long term, so that the private prisons could make more money.
Well, this I know has always frustrated the hell out of Wayne. Is you can't invent a new fetish. Somebody's already invented it before. You can't invent another way to steal business. Somebody's already done it before, right?
That's right. and you know, the other thing I think that Trump and this Commerce Secretary has, I got to make sure I pronounce Letnik. There's a spoonerism that gets into not nice territory, but anyway, Letnik said he foresees, factories coming back where you have multi-generational families working at the same factory, and he said, yeah, we could have factories where Americans are screwing the little screws into the backs of iPhones. The one thing that is not being talked about with all of these, Trump is almost sounding like he's a Soviet central planner. There's no talk about robotics and artificial intelligence, which is a fact of life. Nobody's going to get rid of that.
There's an economic, and I keep bringing back to this because I never thought when I was sitting in these classes, years later, I'd actually remember what the hell they were in there. There's something about this that these guys, even though the Secretary of Treasury and the Secretary of Commerce, they should know all this stuff. You're never, for somebody in your place, your country, to make more than somebody else, there's something called a comparative advantage. A person in the U.S., if you're in Chicago, I'm just picking Chicago, you should be able to make more than somebody in Korea or Vietnam or someplace, because guess what? You got all the water you need, you got all the power you need, you got all the property you need, you've got all the infrastructure, you got the rails, you've got the roads, you've got everything, and you've got space, and the person here, his marginal benefit, I don't want to go on this road. His marginal benefit to the company is going to be a lot more. Therefore, he or she is worth more, not necessarily because they're better people or anything, than somebody who's sewing blue jeans somewhere because maybe they don't have the power, and that's why you have people sewing the stuff. So as long as they're not, slave labor or minority, there's no way that somebody in Vietnam is going to be worth as much, not as a human being, as somebody here with all the advantages we have. Over time, the idea is that Vietnam or wherever it is will end up being able to afford the power plant, being able to do all those kinds of things, to where they are now somewhat equal, and just to be an ass about it, they become a customer, basically. That's the whole theory, or where am I wrong here? If Trump thinks we're going to have a bunch of people screwing stuff, no, we're not. No, nobody wants that job. but I'm saying, because here people don't, put it this way, our people are, does that sound right, are worth more than that, because we can have robotics, we have the power for robotics, we have all those things. Where am I wrong here?
Well, I think you're right, but here's a fundamental issue that I think a lot of Americans historically do not want to think our leaders lie about really fundamental things. So the assumption, and we've raised it, how could leaders possibly believe this? Well, that poses the question, but at some point, maybe the answer is they don't actually believe it, but it's worth it to say. Well, if you see what I mean. Just like we started the program, oh, we're announcing this big deal, UK and US, but will they say it's been 3 years in negotiation, or does it suit their interests to say, no, we worked it out, the new governments.
Well, I've asked everybody else, why are there people in this country who refuse to believe tariffs are a tax on them? How can I be talking to people that are like economic professors and not believe that?
Yeah, and we saw what happened when Amazon was going to put show on these bills that people were getting when ordering stuff from China through Amazon or Temu or whatever, and they said, well, we're going to show the basically the tariff, 145%, which, you know, the tax is more than the product itself. And Trump called Jim Bezos and made all kinds of threats, and he backed down because the White House they don't want people to know that tariffs are a tax.
But how do people not know that?
I mean, it defies logic. And like, there's hearings now. There was hearings this week in the House where they were basically, the Democrats were pointing out these are taxes. They had Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, there, and they kept trying to pin him down. Are these tariffs are a tax, are they not? And, you know, this guy Bessent, he reminds me more of an undertaker. You know, the guy, he's so superficial.
Well, you guys, I'll take the other side of this. What's the question?
Yeah, whatever the question is. Yeah, what were you guys talking about? I'll argue against it.
I can do that. What's the main issue? Tariffs are taxes or are not taxes?
Well, they are taxes. I mean,
So what it comes down to is what happens with the benefits, right? So if the taxes, quote, that are being imposed on the U.S. right now by other places, the benefits of these would outweigh whatever is happening currently or what's happened in the past.
And it's the taxes today. You're paying it, and the idea is that somehow 5 years from now you're going to get it all back.
Well, the tax in the eye of somebody who's lost their job was these taxes have cost us our jobs, and now we're going to.
Well, yeah, but we're assuming that the idea that the other people are screwing us. Well,
screwing or not, but the benefits, cost benefit analysis, whether it means, you know, cash. Jobs, whatever.
Well, Greg, opine on this. Let me get another question here before we'll kick that one around maybe on Monday. But why doesn't just in general? Because you guys know more about the way Congress works than I do, and Greg, feel free to opine. Why do some things not get advanced? When I say advanced, brought up to speed, and other things. My big fat example is when I got in the business, talking 1981. The Dow was at 800 or something along those lines, and the deduction for if any of us lost money in the stock market, the deduction towards ordinary income was $3,000. And here we are 40 years later, it's still $3,000. Where clearly you can lose $3,000 in one of these, in Nvidia and these things, and Tesla in 10 minutes. That has not grown. The alternative minimum tax. You guys weren't alive when this happened, but didn't it affect less than 100 people the first year it went into law? And now everybody has to look at it. Same thing is, I had a big set to with wasn't Hal yesterday? No, was it? Regarding the wait a minute, Kevin. Regarding the $10,000 maximum on, you know, the interest or the other taxes you can take off against your federal tax return. Okay, well, Trump did that in the 8 years in the debacle that was his and Biden's administration. I take them together. because clearly on an inflation thing, they both were involved. Matter of fact, Trump started it. We had a 40% increase in the money supply, and I think a lot of local taxes and stuff have gone up 40%. Not to mention, when the price of a car goes up 40%, the taxes on it goes up 40% as well. You have all kinds of people now that are paying $10,000 in state and local taxes that never were part of this in 2017 or whenever he did it. So, I mean, if you go out and buy a new Jeep, for God's sake, they're $100,000 if you get a nice one. if your sales tax is 11%, you're over the thing. You're not even talking about your property tax. So these little things that seemingly like even more some people, you know, like the Democrats, some people hate them, some people like the Republicans. Whatever it is, both sides of the aisle must be complicit on this kind of crap happening, because they all must know that the minimum or the deduction toward income of a stock or a capital gain should be more than $3,000 today. They all must know that even if this $10,000 limit on local taxes was the right thing to do in 2017, it ought to be 15 now just to be even, and yet it won't be. I mean, how
are you supposed to inflate your debts away when you're adjusting for inflation?
Well, therein lies the question.
I mean, think it's pretty obvious.
I mean, is the government trying to inflate their way out of debt, and are both sides doing it? I guess Greg finally came to the real question. I mean, all these taxes that appear to not affect you in 3 or 4 years do affect you, it appears.
Well, yeah. I think part of the problem, Tom, is going back to your $3,000 example, it affects so many people that the financial consequences are huge, but it doesn't necessarily translate into votes and campaign cash. So suppose they adjusted it. Would you increase your personal donations to a member of Congress who voted for it? Probably not. Whereas if you take inheritance tax, I heard a professor talk about this, and he said, look, they came up with a brilliant public relations strategist who called it the death tax, and got everybody worried about the death tax, because nobody wants to support a death tax. But it affects only a few extremely rich people who care about it a lot. And so they were able to publicize the concept, we've got to raise whatever it was, the death tax from, let's say, $6 million to 15 or whatever the figures were about 15 years ago. But they had a concentrated public relations campaign, even though in the state of Mississippi, the professor said they couldn't find anybody who was actually affected by it, and they found a black chicken farmer who made great ads about it. But it turns out his family wouldn't have been affected because the limit was already, but they used them anyway because people wanted that change and were willing to pay for it.
Well, I
indexing
guess you could,
everything to inflation is an existential risk to their model.
I agree. But I mean, but today, part of the pressure is off a little bit because people are convinced that the market is just nothing but go up and you don't have to worry about losses.
That's part of the inflation.
Well, okay.
It's
I'm
part
saying,
of the deal.
But I'm saying right now, how many people know that are diving into, say, Bitcoin? And they put $100,000 and buy one Bitcoin, which is kind of where it is today. I mean, there are people that are doing this, or 50,000 or whatever they're doing.
Then they'll buy more Bitcoin because they think it's...
All right, what I'm saying is if it happens that all of a sudden somebody hacks Bitcoin and it's worth zero tomorrow, do you think the average person realizes he has to live 33 years to write that off? All it has to take is...
I don't know if they even know they can write that off.
People know that you can write off some capital losses against income. They probably don't know the number. Sure they do.
The Bitcoin people are thinking that they...
All right, forget Bitcoin. Buy NVIDIA, and all of a sudden tomorrow it's a sham, which I don't think it is, and all of a sudden it's $10. All right, so you lose $100 on NVIDIA, 33 years to write it off. Again,
this is the existential risk to their model. If you start doing stuff like that, that means government revenue goes way down.
Well, I understand that, but why do people? I mean, the idea is freedom is not something government gives to people. It's what people take from government. Why isn't the person who goes buys a car tomorrow and pays $10,000 in tax going? Wait a minute.
I think the natural thing is kind of not freedom.
That's why we're special, right, guys? That's why we used to be. That's why we used to be special.
I mean, it's the natural thing is kind of not, and the way we pay for it, our taxes and the
what
way.
All I'm saying is that there's a creep to this that I don't understand to this day and age, when most people have at least taken one economics class. Why they don't at least see what's happening to them? I'm not saying you should run up and down the street with a sandwich sign, but I mean,
everybody can see it. They just don't care. What's the voting turnout?
Not making it part of your day doesn't mean you don't care.
I don't know. What else would it be?
Why don't you guys comment on that? There's a lot of stuff that people see that they don't like, but it's not enough for them to disengage with their normal life to try and do something about. And I think we have a lot of politicians that take advantage of that. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, sure. And I remember I took a course in high school, believe it or not. It was supposed to be a course on critical thinking, but they thought the school board wouldn't go for that. So it was called advertising, but it was on critical thinking.
Same thing.
And the term was used, and I never forgot it. One of the ploys of advertisers is something called glittering generalities. Right. Yeah. And I remember the teacher said, if you see a sign on a store window that says sale, well, God, everything is for sale in there. Yeah. I mean, what is this? And, and the big one, he said, you stay away from is free, because nothing's free. And so you have the same thing going now with the, tariffs are going to put billions of dollars into something called the External Revenue Agency, because we're going to get rid of the IRA. We're going to have the ERA. I mean, all this is like, this is in the software world, they used to call this vaporware.
why doesn't somebody, I mean, we'll talk about it next week, because we're getting over time, but because you guys are, your strong points are the news media. How come the only person, well, I don't listen to all this stuff all day long, so maybe other guys are doing it. Why doesn't somebody mention that the proposed tariff number that these guys are talking about in terms of taxes, which I don't think they're going to make, but if they did, is bigger than all the corporate taxes paid? How many people do you think would sit there and go, it's what? you would hope.
No, I agree.
But nobody ever does that. No, in Chicago, nobody ever mentions. When we talk about the Bears Stadium all day long, nobody ever says this is how much the money the Bears make every year and this is how much they pay in rent. Nobody knows that, but you can argue all day long about it without knowing anything.
Well, here's a very brief answer, because I know we're over time, but some people do mention it, but the question is, can they be employed on a larger platform? And two quick things. I just saw at the National Press Club last night, Jim Acosta, he was commenting on a movie on Russian propaganda. Well, he left CNN because he thought he could do better as an independent video maker on Substack, because they didn't necessarily want his views. And very quickly, we talked about Jeff Bezos knuckling under this tariff question on Amazon. Well, he has other multi-billion dollar contracts for Amazon Web Services and agreements with the Postal Service to ship Amazon products. He's in a squeeze, even though he's one of the four richest people on Earth, that if he doesn't knuckle down on what he says and stay on message, he could lose billions, and he knows it, and so do the people who might work for him. So that's the problem, Tom.
Well, it's doesn't that remind you of, like, Russia?
Yeah.
Well, again, the movie last night was about Russian propaganda and the Russians imprisoning a journalist who wanted to say something independent, and it didn't end well for that journalist.
No. All right, guys, we got a dash. Thank you very much. Next week, it's not like we don't have enough to talk about, is there? God. SP Futures up 4, NASDAQ Futures up 211. We're still up a bunch, but we were up almost 60 when we came in, so we're slipping a little bit. We'll see where that lands. Again, individual stocks, again, Microsoft's up 3. We've got Goldman Sachs up 4. So pretty much to the upside here. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.